Stay out of my way, or you'll pay. Listen to what I say.
Why don't I just go eat some hay? I can make things out of clay or lay by the bay. I just may. What do you say? Hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe. I'm your host, Devin Decker, and joining me, my host, companion, and co-curator, Sejan Serowick. Sejan?
Hello, Devin. I just wanted to let everyone know that tonight's episode comes sponsored by the Foreign Hand Knot for my tie. I'll be honest, I just Googled proper golf tie knot, and what came through was the Foreign Hand. And that's just an over-under, and then a back through. It's really simple, but I think that's saying something. Just like the game of golf. Simple, elegant, but still beautiful.
I'm not wearing a tie this week because we're talking about Happy Gilmore. And if there's ever an episode of the Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe where the proper attire should just be ignored, it's Happy Gilmore.
I'll give you that. I'm all for that, my friend. Yeah, hell yeah, man.
I am wearing a long sleeve shirt underneath a short sleeve shirt. It's black. It's not Bruins, but I'm like halfway there.
Yeah, man. I applaud it because with you there and me shooting McGavin on this end, I'm ready to go.
That's interesting that you would call yourself Shooter McGavin. I mean, I cast you as Shooter McGavin, but we don't need to talk about that here and now. Everybody heard it, right? That plays at the beginning.
You literally did it, but okay, yeah. No.
All right. So we are talking about Happy Gilmore and its connection to the Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe. But what this show is, right, it is us cultivating our own map of an Adam Sandler cinematic universe, and we're still in our first voyage into the realm of the unknown, trying to chart really border points of this universe. Is that wrong? Is there a better term?
We're trying to get a basic map with some easy to tell like landmarks on it so that people can kind of navigate and get around. So this is not going to be the most detailed cartography you've ever come across, but we're going to make sure that you don't crash.
Exactly. And we're also scared, so we don't want to crash. So we're taking it like nice and easy, like, oh, we know that if we go around, we'll come back to where we started. And then we can venture off to the center. Yeah.
No.
We're doing it. I don't know. So that's it. So that's what we're here to do. And the first six we're looking at, just as a quick recap, is going to be Billy Madison, Happy Gilmore. You're here, right? If this were a mall, the big red star would be on Happy Gilmore. And then The Waterboy, Little Nicky, Pixels, and Hubie Halloween. And I think I like saying this list every week because I get to say Pixels.
You get to point out that you snuck Pixels into this list. Yes.
I didn't sneak it in. Adam snuck it in. And I'm so grateful for it. So that's it. That's who we are. You might also know Sejan and I from the other podcast that we do, The Say Report. And that's a show about
that show.
Yeah. Fuck
We're
that
not
show.
Here for that show.
That show is about everything. This show just about Adam Sandler and his movies and the universe, which the universe and everything are kind of synonymous, but now I'm just pulling threads that don't need to be pulled. Right. That's not related to the string theory of the Adam Sandler cinematic universe.
That would be everything else, Devin. We got to stick to the one thing.
But yes, so what we start with is our first impressions watching this film now in year 2021.
I have an inkling of what your impression is, and I kind of want you to go first, not because I want you to look like an asshole when I go, and you're going to kind of feel like one, and I apologize for that in advance.
I didn't like this film as much as I thought I would.
Okay.
And honestly, I think that's because in watching Billy Madison, I got a whole new depth and breadth of understanding. Those were the wrong words to use.
But I'm with you. No, keep going.
But
own
I got
it.
But I did. I gained a deeper appreciation for the film Billy Madison. And I didn't expect that at all. And getting ready to watch Happy Gilmore, I was kind of dreading it, because Happy Gilmore as a kid is the film that I connected to on a deeply personal level. This is a film that, this is the first Adam Sandler starring piece that I saw in the movie theater. My father took me, of all things, not that me and my father didn't go to the cinema together, but this is a movie that, like, it was a Saturday and my father said, come on, we're going to go see Happy Gilmore.
You like that damn Billy so much.
I actually hadn't seen Billy Madison.
No, I know,
don't
right?
think. Yeah. So yeah. It was just one of those. And I don't know why my father wanted to see it. And he flat out refused to elaborate on why when I asked him today.
We can talk about it. I have some theories, but we'll talk about that when
we'll get to those theories because I have some as well. But it wasn't an outright denial of I didn't take you to see that film. It was just I don't want to talk about why we saw Happy Gilmore in the theater. I'm like, okay, Dad, that's fine. Good talk. But this was also a film that I owned on VHS, and I have deep, vivid memories of falling asleep to Happy Gilmore. So mm-hmm. Happy Gilmore, for me, prior to this viewing of the film, is primarily the hockey tryout that is so close to home because I was never a very strong skater.
Ouch.
But,
yep.
But I was good at everything else in hockey. Just like skating, I wasn't the best. And then once I got good, I broke my ankle. So, you know. Life,
I mean, if
man.
You told me at some point that you and I fell asleep to this movie being on in your house, I wouldn't bat an eye. I won't take that bet. Like, if somebody was going to bet against me, I wouldn't. The odds-on favorite would be yes.
Yeah. Because this was also, like, plenty of times coming over, I would just throw this film on. Because that's the connection. And
or
then
it was just on somewhere. Like, this is one of those ones that gets played all the
exactly.
time between TBS, Comedy Central, and HBO. I don't know who shows it more often.
Yeah. I'd love to see those numbers if we could get that somehow. But then also it is him singing Exile. I wanna kiss you all over and over and again. And then the grandma scene and then him meeting Chubbs and... The second Billy gets hit with that first baseball at the batting cages, which, dear God, do I miss going to the batting cages?
Yeah.
That's when I would, like, knock out. Like, it would knock out that little kid who tries it, and I would be asleep, too. So
he gets up. We get to see him in the background.
I was asleep. I never knew that, right? So that there was that. That, like, I never was bothered by it until I'm like, oh, my God. Oh, he gets up. It's fine. So then actually sitting down and watching this film and comparing it to Billy Madison, this movie is a jumbled mess. Like, things just kind of happen in Happy Gilmore in a way that I remembered Billy Madison happening. And that isn't the case. Like, Billy Madison is actually pretty well crafted and plotted out. So then yeah. You get to Happy Gilmore and, like, it's kind of a montage for the second act of the film. Like,
yes, I'm trying to think of the best way to put this. I cannot argue with you that there is definitely something that happens in the back half of this film that is super formulaic. What I constantly kept writing down is, oh, this is just Billy Madison. So it's not necessarily that it happens for no reason. It feels almost like we've seen this movie already once the, like, 40-minute, 50-minute mark hits.
I can understand
after
that.
After the mini-golf course.
Right.
Everything after the mini-golf course feels super formulaic and something that we saw already from him.
And if I can blow your mind, there are 14 minutes left in the movie after the mini-golf course.
I mean, that's... to me, that's going to speak to what I'm about to say about this movie. but that's really, like, up to that moment, it is, I don't want to say unique, because we're going to talk a lot about some of the stuff that he borrows from later on, but up to that moment, it feels like it's its own movie, and then in the last 15 minutes, it feels like it's an Adam Sandler movie.
Which is interesting, because there are up to that point, up to the end resolve moment, there are so many shades of Adam Sandler that I'm mm-hmm. excited to explore when we get to the grander discussion.
Yeah. So what do you, is there anything else you want to get out about this movie before I get into my story about this?
Oh no, please. I think I've gotten it all out on the floor.
So I'm going to preface this entire episode because it deserves to be prefaced this way. It's going to shine on everything else that I say, and also is going to talk to you a little bit more about what this film actually seems to do. This is no joke. This was, however you want to phrase it, one of my grandmothers who passed away at this point 3 years ago. I can't even put a time on it, but this was one of her favorite movies. And the only reason she saw it is, I don't know why, but I can promise you Zach wasn't there. Love you, Zach, but you definitely weren't there for this. I spent like a 2 to 3 day weekend with her one time, and you know, it was the 90s. What did you do? You went out and you rented a movie at Blockbuster. She let me get Happy Gilmore, and I fully intended, whenever me and Zach would go out and do this, we'd always get the movie that mom and dad kind of wanted us to get, and then we were kind of like allowed to get a movie that we wanted to get, and that was it. Two movies, right? That's what we got to do. Generally, the movie that mom and dad wanted us to get was like Mr. Potato Head and Family, or like Teddy Ruxpin or some shit like that, right? And I love those things, and God bless them for letting me get those things time and time and time and time and time again, because they ingrained that shit in my head. But that they were always like the go-to, like, let's grab Mr. Potato Head, and then I'm going to go and see what's new in the comedies. And I got Happy Gilmore. And I fully intended it to be the movie after Grandma went to bed, and I got to stay up late, because that was one of the great things of staying at my grandparents' house. And, like, I would be the one that would get to, like, stay up late and watch whatever I wanted. And it's I once told what's his nuts that directed Hairspray,
Waters.
I once looked John Waters in the face and said, "I got to watch the Demento movie that he made with Keith Sutherland there. That is like fucking super inappropriate for children." I was like, "I got to watch you at 3 o'clock in the morning at my grandmother's house," and he looked me in the eye and was like, "Who the fuck are you?" Yeah. But anyway. But yeah, so I used to get away with murder, right? Like once my grandparents went to bed, like I could fucking dip into the fucking Cheez-Its. I had a crazy ass night, right? Fresca all around. Like, that was the shit, right? So that was the idea with Happy Gilmore, is it was going to be that movie. And for some god awful reason, my grandmother was like, let's watch a movie together. Like, you pick this one up, let's watch this movie. And I was like, okay. And I hadn't watched it yet. I was just like, all right, this was going to be the thing that I watched. And if you're okay with this, it never occurred to me that I might get in trouble. It was just one of those things where I got that like cringy feeling even at that age, where I was like, I don't think you're going to like this movie. And she fucking loved it. The second Bob Barker started beating the shit out of him, she starts laughing her ass off. And it became one of those things where we ended up watching it twice more that weekend, because like I was a little kid and I'll watch anything more than once. And she was just like, let's put this on again. Like, it became this weird thing. And so like, as somebody that has a really, I won't say that I have bad memory, because I'm able to pull a memory as long as there's something that can anchor me to it, right? So, like, you put a smell in front of me, you put a sound in front of me, and I'm like, I'm there instantly. But ask outside of that, and I can't fucking remember shit. This movie gives me such a weird sense memory. Also, specifically, the opening riffs to Leonard Skinner's Tuesday's Gone is like... like, Tim, I don't know why, but it instantly brings me back to this house on Bliss Street in East Providence, Rhode Island, of, like, sitting with my grandmother watching this film. So, like, that is the way that this movie is kind of, like, shaped for me. And, no, like, it is the weirdest coincidence, if you want to say, like, intervention of some deity of some kind, that this is also a movie entirely about, like, Happy and his grandmother. Is like, I cannot separate like that from it, right? So sitting here today watching this movie, like rewatching it for us to record, I smiled the second that those opening guitar riffs come on, and then he starts doing like the VHS intro to this movie, and I couldn't stop smiling till the end. So like, it's really hard for me to to pick at like what you're saying, because I may not disagree with what you're saying about why this movie is like tropey and like we're going to talk about the idea of like the overpowered rookie and like that being like such a huge like concept in movies, and Adam Sandler being somewhat cringy and a little bit of his childish humor. But what's really like, but what drives this entire film for me is this memory of just like, this was a film that not just I loved, but somebody two generations removed from me loved. And I think that is still the case. I will say this as my closing argument on the opening here. This is the movie that I will show my kids. Like when my dad sits me down and shows me fucking like White Christmas and is like, this was funny back when I was a kid. This is the movie that I will do the same to my children with.
That's fair. I can understand that. And actually, once we go a little bit deeper into it, I have a lot of thoughts as to why. I have a lot of thoughts regarding this film and where we put it. But before we get there, do you have any facts and figures to serve up to us about this lovely little flick?
I've got a conspiracy theory, and I'm so happy to share it. It's not a huge conspiracy. It is a decent conspiracy that is probably true and also doesn't affect us if it is. So Happy Gilmore comes out the weekend of February 16th, hitting that February mark, just like we talked about last episode, right? And it seems to be his sweet spot because Billy Madison did so good.
Yep, a year before Billy Madison.
So it does relatively well. In its first weekend, it makes over $8 million. It only cost $12 million to make, so like eventually it passes it and surpasses it. Just like the first time around, like he's able to score about three times as much as he originally like cost to make it, so like he's bank at this point. Like he is a guarantee after this movie. Opens the same weekend as Muppet Treasure Island, which is a weird pull, right? Also opens the same weekend as Mr. Wrong, which I think might be a more interesting thing to compare it to just for a second. Mr. Wrong, for anybody that doesn't remember, is the Ellen DeGeneres comedy. And she, at this point, if I'm not mistaken, at this point has on her show done the reveal, the huge reveal that she is actually a lesbian. And that's like huge on TV. And also then her coming out and doing a romantic anti-comedy, I will call it, is an anti-romantic comedy. I don't know where you want to put that, but that idea that like, it is the idea, it is everything you know about romantic comedies turned on its head, blah, 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 that we end up seeing a million times over, right? That is the same weekend as this, and it kicks the crap out of it, because this ends up coming in second in its week, and sixth for Mr. Wrong. The number one, just to put it out there, is Broken Arrow, and anybody that's seen that movie knows why. That fucking movie rocks, and we will talk about that one day, but that's a different conversation. But yes, Broken Arrow, which was number one the weekend before and is still number one, so like it's like maintaining its slot. But here we go. Do you know what other bad boy comedy is out at this time?
Let's see, 1996, right?
I will tell you this. It's not opening weekend for this comedy. Right, this other comedy has been out for a couple of weeks.
Completely understandable. I mean, my first thought is Dirty Work, but that can't be right. I think that's later.
Way too late. Yeah, that's way too late.
All right. So that's my first jump. You're not
too far off for a specific reason.
Oh, no.
I'll give it to you.
What is it? I concede.
Black Sheep has been out for 3 weeks at this point. This is the third weekend of Chris Farley's second outing. Chris Farley and David Spade's, let's be honest, second outing. The duo, the Abbott and Costello of our time, have made their second movie in 2 years, in as many years. 1995 is Tommy Boy, and then 1996 is Black Sheep. And so this is the second movie for Chris Farley, has been out for 3 weeks, has been doing fucking gangbusters. Like it is over and past its budget. It is already solidified as a blockbuster when Happy Gilmore comes out. Do you know why they had the balls to put a movie out? And it had to be the choice on the Chris Farley side to put it out against Happy Gilmore, because this is 3 years since Billy, but here we are at only a year since Tommy Boy.
Oh no, it's only a year since Billy. Billy Madison is 95.
When I was doing my research, a lot of things were saying 93, but 95 makes sense. Yep. Well, okay then. But do you know what's going on in the head-to-head? That's the important bit, though. Why Chris Farley, friend of Adam Sandler, in many an Adam Sandler movie, is also making movies right beside him and trying to beat him to the punch?
If I had to venture a guess, historically, the reason why Adam Sandler goes and starts making movies in 1995 is because he clashes with SNL and goodbye SNL, I'm going to do what I want to do. And mm-hmm. SNL still retains Chris Farley and David Spade, and I have to imagine that it's SNL who was trying to push these guys to make
not
these movies
SNL.
And dethrone it. Dan Aykroyd also feels like he's part of that, but I kind of lump him in with SNL.
It's the man himself. It is Lorne fucking Michaels.
Yeah.
He's all over Tommy Boy and Black Sheep. And that is, and Coneheads, which is what came out previously that featured Chris Farley in a minor role, right?
Right.
So,
I mean, Coneheads is 93. That's the one that's 93 before they both go and make their own films.
Right. And Lorne, you have to imagine that Lorne Michaels is like shitting himself, seeing Adam Sandler out there competing with his golden boy, Chris Farley, right? So he's keeping pace with him, if not like beating him to the box office. And it is clearly like it is this thing that is going on in comedy at the moment where SNL is defining everything. So even though Adam Sandler is not doing an SNL film, he is competing with one. And he's coming from that like that background. But most notably, one of his first pictures is Mixed Nuts with Steve Martin.
Never called him that before. Like, anyone.
but it is Mixed Nuts with Steve Martin, right? Like, and you get to see him kind of like growing outside of SNL, and I think that's key, is this move of his to try and move away from that gang, and still succeeding, which very few people have been able to achieve.
I mean, the fact that Adam Sandler was going up against SNL and winning is probably one of the reasons I don't give a fuck about SNL anymore. I'm talking like personal experience. Saturday night, I will watch anything but NBC because I don't care about SNL anymore. Yeah. And the fact of the matter is you tried and you failed to Adam Sandler. No offense to Adam Sandler. I'm a big fan, but like, you created the monster that destroyed you, Lorne.
Exactly.
Like it's
yeah, man.
Yeah.
Well, it's why when Sandberg leaves SNL himself, Andy Sandberg, late years later, you see him really latch on to Sandler in that way. Not least of which are like weird Sandler appearances on Brooklyn Nine-Nine. He does That's My Boy. Is that the name of it?
Yep.
The one with. Yeah, with Sandler, like you see, so you see Sandler kind of go, Sandberg do the kind of the same route that Sandler does, where he kind of develops himself outside of the series, and then like the difference between the two of them is with Sandler, I don't want to say he burned bridges because clearly that's not the case. He gets to come back and host years later, and like he still pulls people from there and stuff like that. But like he clearly establishes like, look, I can do this on my own and I don't need you. Whereas like Sandberg is very much just like, I can do this on my own, but it doesn't hurt to have your help. Like, right? Like that's like the in between.
I mean, that feels like someone who is walking down a trail that was blazed by someone who did it on their own. And like understanding, no, it's cool if I can turn back every once in a while.
And also understanding like lightning doesn't strike twice. Like Andy Samberg is, we can speak the praises of him all day and every day, but like one of the smartest moves he ever made was realizing he wasn't Adam Sandler.
Yes.
Like I love the dude, but realizing that he needs an ensemble around him to really kind of make himself shine. Like it's one of the smartest moves that he ever made. Brooklyn Nine-Nine is a shining example of smart casting, both on the show's part and Sandberg's part to take the role.
Yeah, I agree. And also while we have Sandberg in the conversation, and we'll address it later, he has to come up on the show in proper eventually. He also was smart to bring his friends with him. The fact that Jorma Taccone and I can't remember the other guy's name, The Lonely Island,
and yeah.
That like
cast of fucking Hot Rod, like,
yeah,
but yes,
the fact that Hot Rod happens, but also the fact that once he starts doing digital shorts for SNL, he kind of sneaks his comedy buddies who he knows he's good working with onto SNL as players in a way that they didn't make it because we only wanted Andy Samberg. That's something, I mean, I could do a whole podcast just about how Andy Samberg played the game. But
might be the follow-up to this one.
Yeah.
But yeah, man. But right, so Sandler blazes that path, right? And at the end of the day, you have to acknowledge that, like where Billy Madison was a shot in the dark, and like it was this thing that hit, and it hit well, but like one point does not make a pattern. And I will say that not even 2 points make a pattern, but you cannot ignore that at least that Happy Gilmore sets Adam Sandler up in a pretty cushy spot going forward. So like it's going to be hard for me to argue against any issues you have with this movie, because I'm purely stuck in this like beautiful nostalgia memory, and I refuse to leave it. So like take the shots you need to, but you have to at least admit that like this is a movie that succeeds.
Oh, I would never say that this is not a film that succeeds. It does wonderful things. And honestly, prior to what we did with Billy Madison last month, I was right there with you.
Yeah.
Like, and it's, and it was trying to make Lightning Strike Twice for me personally that had this one stumbling.
I will say that success-wise, there are a couple of other movies I should mention. So it comes out. It is second in its weekend to Broken Arrow, which is an understandable like bronze like or silver medal at this point. But here's just a couple of other things to keep in mind that are out this weekend. On its 17th week, Leaving Las Vegas is still out there. On its 39th week, Braveheart is still out there. On its 13th week, Toy Story is still out there. Even just a couple of other ones, Sense and Sensibility and The Juror, which have been out for weeks at this point, are still out there. So, like, it is going up against a moderately heavy hitter schedule. Like, it's not stepping into the dregs. There are a lot of movies that are out that are in their, like, late runs that have been out for weeks. But, like, Toy Story straight up went up in its fucking, in like its 13th week of being on the schedule, actually made more money than it had the week before, which is like unheard of nowadays. Sense and Sensibility was like up its week. So like these are movies that were out for a while, and we've talked about this back in the day that just happens. But on top of that, it's not just that they were out for a while, but they were also improving in their numbers, which is like unheard of nowadays. And it comes out and it beats the snot out of all of them and makes second place.
And that's the kind of stuff that's never going to happen again. It's,
yeah.
And it's disappointing, but it's just the truth.
Yeah. But that's but there you go. Facts and figures.
So those are our facts and figures. You know what we should probably do? We should probably tell the listener what this film is about.
I can't tell you how excited I've been for this very moment. Oh, so I'm going to just mute myself and here we go.
I'm just going to be honest with you. That right there, the pressure was on. So thanks, Sajan. Glad you're muted and can't respond. Happy Gilmore is the story of the titular, colorful, emotional, working-class hero with two things to his name, a short fuse and the strongest slapshot you've ever seen. If only he could skate. After yet another failed hockey tryout, Happy learns his grandmother owes $270,000 in back taxes to the IRS, and if that is not paid in 90 days, she'll lose her house. In a bit of serendipity, he discovers his superior slapshot skills translate to a stunning 450-yard drive in the comparatively mild sport of golf. Happy's long drive skills are noticed by one-handed golf pro Frederick Chubbs Peterson, portrayed by Carl Apollo Creed Weathers, who convinces Gilmore that playing golf will be a way to make the big bucks, and boom, we have a solution for Grandma's money problem. In his first competitive outing, Happy draws the attention of Virginia Vennett, Julie Bowen, the Pro Tour's public relations director and potential romantic interest, and also the ire of the current tour kingpin and most likely to be left out of the League of Evil Sandler villains, Shooter McGavin, Christopher McDonald. After winning the club tournament, despite the protestations of Chubbs that he isn't ready, Happy joins the pro golf tour. Happy's no-nonsense attitude, flair for big passionate reactions, and flavorful language soon makes him the bad boy of the links, and the tour coordinator, Doug, wants him gone. Luckily, Virginia convinces Doug she can manage his more violent tendencies and make him behave so they can reap the rewards of the youthful injection of interest in the sport. Meanwhile, despite his continued success, Shooter decides Happy and all he represents must be stopped. He hires a heckler, and his plan works even better than planned, erupting into an all-out brawl with Bob Barker of The Price is Right. Such a flagrant violation of the rules results in a one-month suspension, but at the last minute, a sponsorship deal with Subway earns Happy the money needed to buy back Grandma's house. Unfortunately, the buyback is actually an auction, and Shooter is able to easily purchase the house and agrees to surrender it to Grandma if Happy quits the tour. Virginia, at this point, steps in and reminds Happy, despite his only goal being to get Grandma's house back, along the way, he became an actual golfer. Happy then issues a challenge to Shooter. Whichever one of them wins the tour championship also wins the house. Happy realizes that now he really needs to learn how to golf, and there is no better man equipped for the job than Chubbs, who teaches Happy to find his happy place in order to tighten up his short game. Their reunion is short-lived, however, as Chubbs suddenly falls out of a window and dies. Now playing for the home of his grandmother and in tribute to his mentor, Happy Gilmore takes to the course, handily defeats Shooter McGavin, and takes home the greatest prize of all, self-worth.
I have to say, at first I was like, man, you're really kind of speeding through this, but then I realized why, because so much happens in this movie. To your point about how things just kind of have to happen in this film in order for it to progress forward. Yeah,
that's, I mean, and that's the real fact of it is this movie is a 90-minute film. It is a quick watch. It's not Infinity War, right? You're not going to be like, oh my God, no. 3 hours? It's not like a latter-day Quentin Tarantino movie that's as long as Pulp Fiction was, but people say it's too long. I don't get that. But,
I don't get it either. Let's talk about other directors that are too long. Hey, Peter Jackson. But yes,
I don't need 3 hours of a monkey when the first movie is 74 minutes. Bring it to New York. That's what we want. But this is a 90-minute film, and it clips because of that. And distilled out and in your memory, it feels so much longer. And in fact, Dennis Dugan, the director of the film, has said he could easily make like a 2.5-hour version of this film with things that were cut from it.
I guess the best thing I could say to that is I would watch a 2.5-hour version of this film, right? Is as much as this movie moves to the point where it is detrimental to the film because, like, things just have to happen in order to move the plot along, I will say that, like, I believe it all. It is all earned every time that it moves forward. As much as it feels like it skips huge like swaths of what's happening, it never feels unearned in its time travel.
Well, I think the fact that it is set at golf tournaments means that and Happy flat out, as soon as he's talking to Chubbs, and Chubbs is like, you need 6 months and I'll make you a great golfer, and he's like, I don't have that kind of time, I'm on a 90-day ticking clock that was established in the second scene of this film,
right?
So I have to go play now. That right there means we're only seeing Happy during the tour. So all the other stuff, all the pushing tin, that's the wrong movie, all the tin cup that we see in the movie Tin Cup, you're not going to get that in this movie. That, like, it tells you right on the tin, we are going to focus on Happy competing.
The only time that comes into play for me, as somebody that is watching this with a completely rose-colored glasses, that rears its ugly head only in one moment, and it is in the final tournament between him and Shooter, in which you see Shooter, like, practicing in the woods to try and do, like, the happy shot, and he just can't pull it off. And that was the first time, notably, like, 70 minutes into this 90-minute movie, it was the first time where I was just like, when is this happening? Like, this feels very out of time for me. And it is probably because it is part of that conceptual 2.5 hour version, right, of Shooter trying to learn the happy shot, like the happy slap shot, the happy slappy shot. But like that moment when you see him like trying to figure out how to do like the 1-2 swing of the slap shot that Happy does. And I did have a moment where I was just like, what the fuck is this? Like, they're in the middle of something. Like, why are you doing this? And then the revelation that the final competition is taking place over like 3 days.
Yeah, it's an actual golf event. It's like the Masters. And I say that because the Masters is the only one that I know where it's not decided based off of one round of golf. It's a tournament. Mm-hmm. So people are playing over 3 days. And their score is added together, and that's how we're going to determine this.
But I am probably way off on this, but also golf tournaments, to my knowledge, are usually round robin. Like, you play with different people every day, and it's a matter of just, you know, the best of the best of the best gets their way through. But I may be way off on that. One of our listeners can correct me if I'm wrong. It was just weird that he was playing against Shooter for 3 days straight, because I was like, that wouldn't be what it was, right?
It depends, honestly. Sometimes when you get to those higher level tournaments, and this is all from just golf being on in the background in this house that I share with my father.
Right. We should admit that that's where we're both coming from.
Yeah.
Is like, we don't watch golf, but like, golf happened around us a lot.
Right. I've never played golf. My golf experience is Mario Golf. Otherwise, it's mini golf at Fiddlesticks.
And Tiger Woods. Tiger Woods is something that we both know of.
Yeah, but I've never played it. I know who Tiger Woods is, right? But I more know him for his work at Perkins than on the links.
I more know him for his work with a fucking 9-iron going at somebody's back window.
Yeah.
But yeah.
But yes, it's one of those situations where it's that. But sometimes in the bigger tournaments, you are just assigned a partner, and that's who you play with for those days. So that you guys establish, you know, this is when we're going, this is our schedule, and we go and we move forward. So
enough
that,
about golf.
Yeah. Well, I mean, but it's just one of those situations where, like, if you were switching your partner every day, you, like, the guy who played first might be paired with the guy who started last, and that wouldn't be fair to the guy who started last.
Fair. Yeah. Exactly. So there is a semblance of golf in this movie, and that is notable in the casting, because they actually get to they one of the dudes that is the announcers is an actual golf announcer. Oh, fuck me, I gotta pull his name up. And he is just like, residual checks from that movie, and it's amazing. And it's like, yeah, hell yeah, man.
And he doesn't talk at all in the movie. That's the whole joke, is that the announcer who talks is not an announcer.
Yeah.
Why wouldn't you be happy? But you also have Mark Lai, who is my favorite cameo, because he's literally just in one scene to give exposition. And it's even better because, like, oh my god, that's Mark Lai, and Happy has no idea who he is, but Mark Lai says to him, oh, you're Happy Gilmore, you got that hole in one on the par 4.
He's just like, you know, most people in the same room can't do that shit. And that is an important moment. Fuck, I'm giving my notes away, but let's talk about it. That moment is hugely important because it's the first time that Happy gets recognized for a feat in sports, because he does not get recognized for that in hockey, despite the fact that he has an amazing slap shot. And we hear two dudes talk about how amazing his slap shot is, but they still refuse to give him that, like, satisfaction. So, like, it's the first time that Happy gets complimented for being good at a sport, and, like, Happy noticeably was like, oh, thank you. Like, he's just, like, thrown off by the idea that he is, like, given praise for being good at a sport.
You heard about that?
yeah, exactly. It is actually kind of a really cute moment for Happy, where he's just like, oh, all right then.
Cool. High fives all around. Yeah, it's so that moment. And then Lee Trevino, who, I mean, for most people in our generation, Lee Trevino's putting challenge in The Simpsons' Marge Be Not Proud is where our mind goes when we hear the name Lee Trevino. But he's also pretty much just a cameo, but he's so hilarious in the film as the guy who just shakes his head at everything that Happy does that flies in the face of golf. And he gets the, like, killer fucking line of, Grizzly Adams did have a beard. Like, he's so good. Okay, Lee Trevino, you have selected Power Shot. And then that's made even better when you hear that Lee Trevino, if he had been able to read the rest of the script, would not have done the film. So the fact that he exists in the movie to shake his head disapprovingly at what is happening in the film is fantastic, because in real life, Lee Trevino shakes his head at what is happening in this film.
Oh, shit. All right. All right. We have to get into old, new,
yeah,
something blue.
The like, feature maybe that is ours, right? It's what makes the Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe our podcast. And that means it's time for something old, something new, something borrowed, and something blue.
I'll be honest. I at first struggled with the old, and then had actually a couple of things for the old. But I want to hear where you go with it first.
Okay.
So
my old, and it's something that is where Adam Sandler comes from, is Robert Smigel coming in again. He was Mr. Oblashki in the first film. And here he plays the IRS guy. You hate me, don't you? Now you're really going to hate me.
He hates me.
Yep. So Robert Smigel coming back from Billy Madison and being there. But then also, a little bit of research. I thought this was Alan Covert's first time being in an Adam Sandler film. Alan Covert, you know him as Grandma's Boy. And then he's just in almost every Adam Sandler movie.
He is Otto in this movie.
Yeah, he is Otto. And Otto is not named at all in this film.
Except we love him.
he's fantastic. He does a really good job in the movie. But Alan Covert, and we'll have to explore it going forward, Going Overboard is where he and Adam Sandler first worked together. The old for me is Adam Sandler bringing back his buddies. Like, if he worked with someone and he liked working with that person, you know he's going to try to find a place for them to go in his films going forward. Loyalty is my old.
You done stole my Alan Covert, but that's okay because I wrote a second one down. And this one's a little bit more ethereal, and I will admit that. But it's because you stole my Alan Covert, like actual thing that he brought back. But my old for this movie has to be the concept of the other side of the buffoon. So, like, last week, and I'm totally, like, riding the wave of what I said last month when I brought up the idea of the buffoon. But what we're seeing here is everything else, right? Like he is literally not the buffoon in this movie. And that's not new to him. It is what we get to fall in love with in Airheads. It is what we get to fall in love with in Mixed Nuts. It is that ideal that he gets to be a guy that is still not, like, he's not gonna cop to being the smartest guy in the room. Like, there's plenty of moments in this movie where he's caught off guard being the idiot, but he is completely aware of who he is at all times in this movie. Like he never assumes himself to be better than he ever is. It's legitimately just this idea of this character that is just like the everyman. But, like, the everyman to a point where, like, he can get shit on sometimes. And, so the other side of Sandler, which we have seen in plenty of his stand-up by at this point, like, he's never afraid to make himself the butt of the joke. But also, like, I'm going to just say, bounced against what he did in Billy Madison, clearly an effort in this movie to be everything but that.
I will agree. In fact, in my notes I wrote down, I like how intelligent Happy presents in this film. Like, mm-hmm. Like, he's clearly not a genius, but he's clearly not an idiot. He's just a regular dude. And coming off of Billy Madison, that's huge. That's a huge thing to see.
Mm-hmm. And I will argue that even in Billy, he's not an idiot. And I think going forward, he always makes sure to show to you that, like, even as silly as his character is, and we'll get to this more in things like The Waterboy and even Hubie, but, like, the ways in which he presents as not dumb, like, he knows the situation, he just, life has put him in a specific place that he doesn't ever force himself out of until a situation calls for him to. And that is key with this movie, is like, he's not a dumb dude. He's not even bad at what he does. It's just that, like, life puts him in a position where he needs to overcome it, and that's finally when you finally see him. It's only through diversity that we get at adversity. It is only through
Adversity,
adversity.
yeah.
Yeah, it is only through adversity that, like, that he gets to, like, shine. And I think that is going to be something huge going forward with Sandler characters.
Excellent. So for new, since I stole your Alan Covert, you can go first, because you'll
Okay.
probably steal my new.
There's a whole bunch of new. That's the problem. I'm going to say this. Here's the one that I'll take. I
Oh,
have a list.
wait. I just, one other thing. In the old category, penguins. That was my other one. The penguins show up in that one scene.
I'm going to leave this open, and out of the three that I have written down, I'm going to just I'm going to whittle this down to just one. Carl Weathers, not as an actor, but as a concept in Sandler movies, going like that is the new thing that shows up in this that wasn't quite there in Billy Madison, but definitely continues going forward, is the idea of bringing in the respected, like, actor, and not just respected by the audience, but clearly respected by Sandler, and, like, brought in to be, like, somebody that he's just happy to be working with. And it becomes this thing that, like, later on becomes, like, kind of like wish fulfillment for him, where he's just like, I've always wanted to work with Al Pacino, so, like, let's write a role for Al Pacino. And then he gets him in on Jack and Jill, right? And I think Carl Weathers is emblematic of that. So that is my new, is that this is the moment where we get to see him be successful enough where he gets to go to somebody like Carl Weathers and say, you want to be in a dumb movie for two scenes? Like, he literally shows up for maybe three scenes, and he's just like, you show up for this for 3 days of shooting, and, like, I'd love to work with you. And that is the first time we get to see it here, and it never goes away.
That is excellent, and whew, I am wiping my brow because that's not my new at all. I really focused in on the collaborators that Adam Sandler brings in, and who is added to the,
Collaborators.
yeah, the actors that are in these films, who then Adam Sandler considers to be part of his toy box going forward. So Dennis Dugan, I think, is the most significant new that we see in this movie. He portrays Doug, the tour coordinator, and he also
I have it written down
directs
already.
the movie.
He's the
And
director of the film.
going forward, directs a lot of Adam Sandler
Yes,
films.
we're going to be talking about Dugan a lot, but Dugan was my number two on this list.
Yeah,
Hell yeah, man.
because it's important. It's that. And then, as just a slant of that, it's Julie Bowen. And we're going to definitely explore Julie Bowen and her connection to the Sandler verse much further down the line, when it is a more significant, like, existence of her as a concept, the same way that Carl Weathers is.
Can I give you a
I'd love to hear your
I
third.
mean,
I said
like,
my penguin one, so.
yeah, but he is, but you're she is, yeah, Julie Bowen is a phenomenal pull, because, like, I definitely thought about her because of her, like, ripple effect later on down the line, but I can't believe that you didn't pull out Kevin Nealon. Like, Kevin Nealon in this film being the start of that. We talked about this last episode, the idea that he becomes, like, the safe go-to as a returning actor for a lot of, like, the roles that he has later on. It's like Kevin Nealon, and I will also say this about Tim Meadows. He just hasn't gotten there yet, and we'll get to it when Tim Meadows finally shows up. But like, Kevin Nealon becomes kind of like the guaranteed, like I need a guy in this role that can either handle this, like, problematic material, or like, it's not gonna be funny unless we got a dude like Nealon in, right? Like, and there is a specific role in Little Nicky that I'm thinking of,
I know, and that's why I didn't bring up Kevin Nealon,
but like Nealon,
because of Little Nicky.
Nealon is the guy that he starts to kind of, I won't say lean on, but he looks to as, like, somebody he can depend on, because, like, I mean, you think about guys like Farley, and you think about guys like even Spade and Schneider later on, who he clearly loves and he works with till the end of time. But like, they all have moments in their life that make it really hard to work with them, right? And I don't know shit about Kevin Nealon other than what I know from like trades and all that shit. But from what I know about Nealon's like work history and the way that people work with him, he becomes somebody that is much more dependable than guys like Farley and Spade and stuff like that. And so like Nealon becomes this kind of thing he can depend on and rely on as a character that is fun to work with, fun to be on screen, but not necessarily something that the main character needs to kneel on. And like, and so you bring in Nealon for that, right?
Very true. The problem with me and Kevin Nealon is because he is such a like background part of Adam Sandler films, he almost blends in a way that's disappointing. Yeah. And specifically his role in Happy Gilmore is the name of the movie we're talking about. We've been talking about it for 50 minutes. I wonder if it was meant for him, because I feel like if they could have gotten Chevy Chase to basically play his character from Caddyshack, they would have tried to do that. Just it's as funny. One more fuck you to SNL. I mean, Kevin Nealon is a fuck you to SNL for obvious reasons, but like if Chevy Chase weren't fucking crazy, I feel like it would have happened. And then later on it does with Norm Macdonald in Dirty Work, which is why my mind went there.
Nice. It's funny that you mentioned SNL and Chevy Chase and Nealon and Norm Macdonald and all that, because I've got something for Borrowed that I really want to get into.
Oh, take it, man. I will concede Borrowed to you for the start.
So I think that there's a larger genre in film where it is the rookie. And it is specifically like the guy that is brought in who is the underdog, and the underdog story is loved in film, right? And so this is everything from literally the film The Rookie to what's the Marky Mark one that is about
Invincible.
Him Invincible, right? But then you have this, you also have, I will even go so far as to say, Angels in the Outfield, right? Where you have the kid that comes in, the kid, quotation marks, that really kind of like changes the game, right? But there is a specific subgenre within that genre, which is the like the rookie with devastating power, which is why I will go to something like Angels in the Outfield.
Fair.
But you also have Major League, which is another big example I will point to, right? With Charlie Sheen playing the animal,
beast.
Right? The beast. That's what it is. But like he, but the idea of the beast guy that is the guy that is
Wild Thing. Sorry.
Somewhat trained in this, right? Yeah. But he is somewhat trained in this sport, if not trained at all. Like that has to be key. And they come into this environment and they just devastate everybody. But there's like this weird hook where like they can't control the power that they have, right? And that is like this huge genre throughout. And so the Borrowed for me is that concept of like the larger film of like the devastating rookie, or like the rookie who doesn't play by the rules. And like Sandler takes that concept and makes it very homegrown, and like and I don't know if he intended this or not, but like with golf, it brings it down to a battle between really just two people. Because on any given Sunday when you watch golf, it's just two guys going against each other. As this movie perfectly shows, like the idea that it's when they do matchups, they always just do one against one. Despite the fact that it is a tournament, you never really kind of see anybody else. And that's true of any golf that you watch. And so, like, the idea of the devastating rookie is something that he borrows from film and we see for years later. And it still goes on today.
Wonderful. I'm really happy that, A, you didn't go with where I went for Borrowed, and, B, you introduced the one versus one aspect of this film. Because this got under my skin, I'm going to say 4 weeks ago. That's too many weeks. 3 weeks ago, watching an episode of the new Magnum P.I. And in the new Magnum P.I., Higgins is a lady, and her new boyfriend was going to take her ice skating at the ice rink during the hurricane because he knew that they could be alone. And two thoughts jumped into my head regarding the solo ice skating date. The first was Happy Gilmore. The second was Rocky. And those two movies existing in my mind at the same time, I put a Rocky filter over Happy Gilmore. And Happy Gilmore is kind of Rocky.
I mean,
in this way that I wasn't prepared for.
I don't think that's a mistake. I will say that I don't think it's a direct Rocky knockoff. But like, yeah, man, the sports film, and what's rarer is the individual sports film, right?
Yeah.
Like, he's not depending on a team, which is very rare in sports movies, but happens. Rocky being a great example.
Right. And I think that, like, so I get the idea of Rocky in my mind. So specifically my borrowed is the ice rink scene. Almost down to, like, the guy who's there on the Zamboni. His outfit is very reminiscent of the guy who kicks Rocky and Adrian out of the ice rink because they're closing in 15 minutes at the start of that scene.
But in this one, he sings the...
But in this one, he's totally into it, right? Yeah. So, like, I had always thought of it just as being framed by the fact that Happy's first love is hockey. So, of course, he'd want to share ice skating with her. And that whole puck thing, and, you know, I'm sure we'll be talking about that. But thinking of it, like, it then suddenly jumps into my mind, why you get Carl Weathers for this film is so that on a subconscious level, you're already thinking about Rocky.
Yeah, man. I never thought about it until you said that, but I'm happy to be right now. Fuck yeah.
Yeah, and even down to the fact that, like, spoilers for Rocky, which came out in 1970...
It's a phenomenal film, so go fucking
watch it. He doesn't win in the first Rocky film.
Which is part of why it's a phenomenal
film. Which is why it's so good. Because what he walks away from and what he is fighting for is self-worth. Rocky wants to be proud of himself and prove that he can do something. And the third act of Happy Gilmore is that same sort of, you're doing this because you want to finish something. That's what will make your grandmother proud of you. Not just getting her house, like finishing something. Cause you've never done that, Happy. And even though they,
before you go too far. No, it's okay. But when you say third act of this film though, I think it's important. And this may explain a thing or two about feelings about this film. What is the third act of this movie? Like, what do you think is the third act of this film?
So the third act,
I've already said that I think it's after the fucking mini golf, and you pointed out it's 14 minutes of a 90-minute film.
Right. So I would actually say that the third act starts as soon as the challenge is, the gauntlet is thrown down with whoever ends up winning the tour championship gets my grandmother's house.
Okay.
So, and then like the next scene, and then Happy says, I need to go learn how to golf.
All right.
And then you get into the mini golf scene. So
right,
like,
sorry, you can continue. I just needed to know what, when you say third act of this film, I needed to clarify exactly what that was.
Right. So, I mean, the third act of this film really mirrors a Rocky film to the point where, like, that's when Rocky starts training for real. It's when Gonna Fly Now plays and you see him a little bad and then getting better. It mirrors that whole aspect of it. With, like, the first hole you're not very good at putting, and then you suddenly get better. And it's actually cool that it's distilled down to what that montage would look like if you didn't have Eye of the Tiger playing at that time.
Right.
And then, you know, Chubb's passing away, that's Rocky losing Mickey in Rocky III. So it's it really, the third act of this film kind of distills down a Rocky movie into 15-20 minutes.
Yeah.
And it's kind of crazy. Like, I never would have considered it that way, but even then, at the end of it, had Happy lost, and unfortunately, Rocky winning in Rocky 2 changed the narrative of the Rocky movies, where, like, you know Rocky's gonna win. It's
and
never a question.
Narrative of sports movies.
Yeah.
Like it's not just Rocky at that point. Once Rocky II basically changes the narrative of film, it becomes a narrative for all sports movies going forward.
Yeah. So Happy can't lose, right? But
right.
I almost feel like if he had, but he had played his fucking heart out and actually tried and got there, he would have been okay with it. Like, you know, they put a bunch of trappings where, like, his grandmother would have been fucking homeless. But
they wrote in a perfect out. Why couldn't have Subway just bought a house? That would have been a phenomenal ending. He loses the house, but then Subway buys him a new house. And he's just like, and we made it exactly like the old house, Grandma. The end. Like, I'm with you on that. There's so many ways they could have wrote themselves out of that hole.
There's so there's a way that, like, Happy Gilmore loses. But the fact that he tried, it was never about the jacket. It was about finishing something. Like, it sets that up. And I feel like if this were the 2.5 hour version, they could have easily transitioned that.
It's a product of the early 90s, I think, man. Like that early mid 90s attitude of like he can't lose. Like that has to be the product of its time.
Fuck you, because Parker Lewis.
If it was written 10 years earlier or 10 years later, like you would have you bet like I bet he would have lost, but there would have been some resolution. Which is another version of a cop out, but you know, it is what it is.
I mean, but, like if he bet on himself, I'd be fine with that.
Yeah. Right. Or like he figures out that like fucking Carl Weathers had bet on him before he died and he gets the winnings because that was in his will or some nonsense.
Yeah.
Because this movie just does whatever it wants.
Yeah. Or even that, or like if Chubbs's house was left to him, like there's a million ways that you can do it where he doesn't win. And right. I think that, all of those are supported by the fact that so many beats of specifically the third act of this film mirror a Rocky movie.
Yeah.
And I was impressed. Like it really, that is something that elevated for me. And I think that's why the middle part where, you know, Happy Gilmore is going through grades 1 through 9 just felt like samey to me.
Yeah. Yeah, man. For sure. All right. So last but not least, we have to talk about the blue. And I have to ask you first. What did you find?
Oh, well, this one, there's a lot of blue things in this movie. Like an upsetting amount of blue things are in this movie.
You literally heard me just knock over shit on my desk because that's not what I expected you to see. Because I was looking for blue shit and couldn't find fuck all.
There's so many blue things in this movie. But I'm going to take the one that's like least likely to be repeated. And that's the fact that the hockey jerseys that Happy and his father wear in the opening VHS home movie intro are a nice deep royal blue.
Yeah, so every now and then they're they're fucking Bruins jerseys, which God love them, like I'm so down for that. But then every now and then they're these blue jerseys that are unnamed. And I have to imagine that there's like a hockey team in New York that they're like really going after, right?
I kind of feel like they're going after the Whalers because he has a bunch of hockey memorabilia in there. But the fact that it's Waterbury, Connecticut would totally be the kind of place that would have a golf course.
Okay.
And the Hartford Whalers stuff, there's a higher concentration of it. And, you know, they were what they were at the time. They were very well known in the 90s. So it would make sense that he would be a fan of the Bruins and the Whalers.
Yeah, the Rangers aren't new, right? Like,
no,
the Rangers
aren't new, but I don't think he'd be a Rangers fan. Not the Islanders. The New York Rangers, yeah, that's the third one that it could be. Because he wears an outfit that looks like it.
He wears like weirdly for 1 second, but the Rangers are red, white, and blue, not orange, white, and blue. Yeah, it's weird. There was definitely moments where that, but then the rest of the time he's branded Bruins. So I don't know if like he talked to the NHL and was like, "We'll give you one team or what." But like,
I think as far as he's from Manchester, New Hampshire, so he's probably a Bruins fan,
right?
But yeah, this movie is very, very floaty with where it takes place. Because the first pro tour golf tour championship is in Portland, and he drives there. So I have to imagine
Seattle.
It's Portland, Maine.
Yeah, one of them is Seattle, and like they don't mention exactly where. Like they don't mention how he got there. And I'm just thinking, right. Did he take a fucking plane there? Did they pay for his plane? I think
they pay for it if you're pro. Like, it's weird how that stuff works. Like, it's especially Happy and what he's bringing to it. This is more discussion stuff to go into. But then also Cleveland, Dallas, and San Francisco are where three other ones occur. So, like, there is almost no, like, it's so floaty. It's wherever it wants to be.
Ohio proudly claims Happy Gilmore as one of the movies that takes place there, despite the fact I think it's one tournament in this entire movie, which as we've established, is all of 3 minutes of this film.
But it is the tournament where he's like, come on, make some noise. Like, you see the word Cleveland pretty prominently in that moment.
Yeah.
But yeah. So my blue is going to be those hockey jerseys. What about your blue, Seijin?
So, as is will be tradition on this show, my blue is going to mean something else entirely, as in, like, the thing that he's probably not going to be able to get away with nowadays, or if he did, it would be very cringy. And there's not much in this film. I'll be entirely honest. There really isn't. And I'm even stretching on this because of the ways in which it's handled. But I have to say the most blue comedy in this movie has to be Chubbs's hand, right? And, like... And, like, the ways in which, like, his disability is handled, or, as I should really say, ignored, which actually might be considered progressive, really, if you really want to talk about it. The only other thing I should throw this out there is just the ways in which Otto is handled, the homeless person that becomes his caddy, although it's never established that he's actually homeless, but, like, the ways in which he is portrayed is not always great, but also never insulting. Like, he, like, the moment where he's taking a bath in, like, the water of the football golf course
is what you're looking for. I can't let you, I can't want you hang yourself anymore, Siege. I'm sorry.
Thank you. Anyway, so, like, the golf diamond in which he is taking this bath in the pond, right? Like, that might be the worst of it for Otto. You know, there's jokes about him washing his underwear in the ball cleaner, but honestly, that's not really a homeless joke to me. That's more just like a silly joke to me, right? So anyway, Otto aside, which I have to acknowledge is kind of an awkward thing, but I still think would probably fly today. I don't know if the comedy with Chubbs's disability would be nearly as prominent or if it would be something different. But I say that. And then the other side of that conversation is like he talks about his hand being homemade. He like, it never stops him from, like, helping Happy in any way. Like, he is an actual good teacher. I don't know. And it's only around for, like, two out of his three scenes. So I it's a stretch for me to call that out. But I think that is the thing that I'd probably call out of anything else in this movie.
Yeah, I mean, the second you said this is the movie you would show to your kids someday, if it's time to share Adam Sandler with them, my initial thought was, because there's really nothing that's not kid-friendly in this, and it feels like that's also kind of a reaction to Billy Madison, is, like, we did this and we had some adult stuff, so let's, like, try to do this but without that adult humor. Like, let's not alienate kids the way that Billy Madison potentially could. I mean, we're living a time in the 90s where, like, The Simpsons was making people clutch their pearls, and those first seasons of The Simpsons literally are so clean and sanitized compared to what we see now. I can't believe anybody was ever frightened of The Simpsons.
For sure. And I think we even talked about this with Billy Madison is like, he clearly is making an effort to be more all around family friendly. And I don't mean that in, like, he's toning his shit down for kids, but so much as, like, he's just trying to make sure that the jokes and comedy he makes are going to be something that anybody and everybody is going to get. And then, like, going forward, are never going to get old. And this movie feels so geared towards timelessness. I won't say that it actually is, but it feels like an attempt towards being more than Billy Madison ever was.
Do you ever notice that in movies is the only time someone orders specifically a Pepsi? Because that's something I noticed in this movie.
make it a diet. But yeah, when he asked for the Pepsi, because God knows nobody in real life would ever ask for one.
Yeah. You know what I've never heard in a restaurant? I'll have a Pepsi. Is Coke okay? Coke's preferred. I just thought you guys were savages. Like, that's it. And also on the topic of your definition of blue, I hadn't even considered it. There are moments that I was expecting to be blue, but then they're played like so woke for 2021 that it kind of blew my mind.
I mean, there's a few moments like that when the old lady asks to get her breast signed. When the older Asian female shows up at his door when it's not his wife,
it's not his girlfriend, and she stays the night, and clearly it's consensual. Mm-hmm. Like that's a really nice moment, and you know, and then the big one is the hockey puck thing where he's like, "You make the shot, then you know I'll never ask you out again. But if you don't, you gotta give me a big smooch." And like that's trope 101, but where right. Adam Sandler and why we're celebrating him and looking into his universe is because right from the beginning he was willing to take that trope and subvert the hell out of it.
Yeah,
because
she makes the shot, right? And
right.
She still chooses to kiss him,
and then it
says
is her agency that says, "I didn't see it go in," and they kiss, mm-hmm. and that's really nice. That's
I mean,
really,
even their
really
first.
Nice.
Yeah, their first real moment where it elevates for them is the golf course when he gets quote unquote
ninth green at nine,
right? And he is soaked and he walks up to her and she explains like, oh, this is something that they just do, their assholes, and he sees the opportunity to like jump on like something with her, but then doesn't choose to do it. It establishes this idea that there is chemistry between them in a way that a movie like this nowadays doesn't bother to do. like there is a legitimate chemistry between the two leads in this film that we never see in comedies, never ever more, like unless it's like some purportedly like indie or like progressive comedy in which they're like, we're gonna show that these two people actually love each other, and it's like, oh, that's nice.
Oh, you mean that thing that happens in real life sometimes? You guys are gonna treat that like an actual plot point? Please tell me more.
Yeah,
and I think that's one of the reasons why Julie Bowen is going to be someone that is worth talking about going forward, and not just because she's now part of the roster. Where did I want to go from this? I was real proud of that roster talk.
So I mean, we're at that point of the show where we talk about, is there anything that we really like missed that we definitely think needs to be out there? Like, is there anything in this movie that we have yet to talk about that you feel like should be talked about?
So the big one for me is Eric Gordon from Billy Madison. I decreed him the Lex Luthor of the League of Evil Sandler villains.
Yep.
I don't know if Shooter McGavin even gets an invitation.
Oh, ouch. I was going to say, did you change your opinion? But okay. All right. What, like... I wrote down, literally, my first note is Shooter McGavin is the worst. Shooter McGavin is just the worst.
I wrote down, the difference between a villain like Eric and Shooter is I know that Eric is an immoral son of a bitch. His morality is pointed directly towards evil in every situation. Shooter McGavin... like, there's a way to make this movie with Shooter McGavin as the hero. And I couldn't do that for Eric Gordon.
I disagree. And I disagree because the very first scene in which we see him, he ignores Vivian. Is that, that's her name, right? In this
Virginia.
One?
Virginia Bennett.
Virginia. He ignores Virginia, walks, like, demands a Pepsi from her, and then has that line about the Diet Pepsi. And they establish in that moment that he is just the fucking worst.
Right, but he's a kind of worst that we all have to deal with.
A like, realistic version of the worst.
He's an everyman of evil.
I love that.
And I think that's where like it's one of these situations where, I mean, you can also look at someone like Shooter McGavin. He represents the old guard, and Happy Gilmore represents. That's the first time I did it. I'm proud of myself. he represents a changing of the guard. he represents progress. So if you want to look at that, where like everything I've come to know and love is being shut down, I mean, another kind of borrowed aspect is the Caddyshack of it all, and the fact that, you know, Shooter McGavin is Ted Knight and Happy Gilmore is Rodney Dangerfield.
But it's part of that whole the badass rookie, right?
Right.
Like, is that story is also present in Caddyshack as well?
Yeah.
Yeah, with the younger kid in that whole story.
Yeah, Danny. That's I can't think of his last name. So it's just one of those situations where, like, he's not as, like, I've seen worse. I've seen worse people play that role, and like, even by the end, I could like kind of see that, like, well, Shooter McGavin is going to be like Elliot Gould to these people, and maybe he's like out there recruiting or like giving money, like helping out in that way.
Now,
right?
You know who he is. He's the fucking dude that gets brought onto the team, but he is so easily swayed by like money and fame that he ends up like turning on the villain team at some point, but he only ends up turning on them to like people that don't matter in the long scheme.
Yeah,
of
for
things.
His own, he's Ellis from fucking Die Hard.
Exactly.
Yeah, Ellis is not a terrorist, but he's still a guy that you have to deal with in the office.
And he gets killed halfway through the film. So like that is who Shooter McGavin is for sure. Yes.
Shooter McGavin is fodder, and it's that. But like also we talked about in Billy Madison, I might be getting ahead of myself here, where he. Adam Sandler's characters kind of bring the people down to his level. Shooter McGavin is unique in while he definitely he's changed by the presence of Happy Gilmore, he still wants to play by the rules as he understands and knows them.
I'm sorry. Do you forget him twice calling in a dude to both fuck with Billy? Sorry, I did it now too. But fuck with Happy, and then eventually run Happy over with a car.
Right, but that's what I'm talking about. He's happier to hire out his deviousness.
Sure.
He's not going to get his hands dirty. Like if there were a fist fight, with Billy and Shooter. Then Shooter is brought into the mud with Happy. I need to stop. I'm sorry. Shooter gets pulled into the mud with Happy. That's different. And Eric definitely gets pulled into the mud with Billy. That's undeniable.
I will say that there is only one moment where I noted for Shooter McGavin where Billy is like picking on him in childish voice and Shooter shoots back. And it's really only in the last third of this film. Like with Shooter over Eric, it's much more of a build to this moment, whereas with Eric, we see it literally in the first scene with Eric at the table, where Billy says something and then Eric shoots like a face back at him from across the table. So like Eric is kind of already down at his level when Billy Madison starts, but Shooter, he gets like winnowed down to that. Like he gets really driven to that point, and then it only comes out in really one moment.
Yeah. And that was just very interesting to me that like, cause that's a big difference. That's a big difference where like we're talking that this film is kind of beat for beat Billy Madison in a lot of ways, except the villain, they take the time to cultivate him and make him different. And really what Shooter McGavin is fighting against is change, and Happy Gilmore just becomes an avatar of that change.
Yeah, and I will say that my argument really is, and I even have this in my notes as quote-unquote the bet, this is the moment when it becomes Billy Madison for me, is the moment when he makes the bet with him for the house. That is the moment when it's like, oh, this is now just Billy Madison. Because in Billy Madison, as we talked about, there's that moment where he makes the bet with him for the company, where he's like, I can beat you in a deca triathlon or whatever the fucking nonsense they call
decathlon.
It. And he says, if I beat you in these things, I win the company. We see that literal same thing happen in Happy Gilmore. And that is the moment when it becomes Billy Madison for me. Is like, it's not really up to that point, really beat for beat, but like there's shades of it, shadow of it. That is the moment when it becomes like, okay, you've fallen back on a tried and true concept. And like, and as much as that's disappointing from the filmmaker side of me, from like the smile on my face, I've been having a happy time this whole time. Like I'm almost in that moment relieved that I kind of know how this is going to resolve. Right. Like there's no question to me how this is going to end at that point.
It's comforting. It's a shift in gears to something that you understand.
Yes.
And it's important. It's important that shift looking forward to pretty much every Adam Sandler movie we're going to look at is that moment of familiarity.
Yeah, that moment when you realize like you're in for something that your body is prepared for, right? Like you're like, I get how this is going to go and I am okay with it.
Mm-hmm. Anything else from you that you feel needs to be discussed?
Couple small things. Real hard to watch this movie and not get a McEnroe vibe, a John McEnroe vibe. Like, you know, like John McEnroe was really huge throughout the 80s, and here we are in the early 90s making a film about a dude that gets real angry on the golf course. Anybody that doesn't know, McEnroe was a tennis player that was famous for, like, swearing and yelling at refs and stuff like that. So, like, just out there in the ether, like, where this comedy is coming from. We didn't talk about, like, the... One of the big things that happens in this movie is you finally get to see Sandler pulling in a lot of not just comedy people in the future with guys like Nealon, right? Or even like pointing to Aaron, what's his name, that plays Otto,
Alan Covert.
Thank you. Like stuff like that, but also like paying tribute to dudes like Ben Stiller, starting at the top of the list, mm-hmm. right? Like Ben Stiller is in this movie and firmly established as a comedic like force at this point, right?
I had in my notes I wrote, where was Ben Stiller in his career at this time? And then I looked it up and I'm like, we're not gonna say that because we're gonna look like a fucking idiot if we ask that question.
Frances Bay, who plays
his grandmother,
who plays his grandmother in this film, she was on the Ben Stiller show that year as a character, as an old lady character with Stiller.
Yeah.
So, like, she has, like, a working relationship with him. So, like, the scenes in this movie, there's, like, a moment where you're like, oh, my God, Ben Stiller had to scream in this old lady's face. But they've straight up worked together on multiple projects.
That's the reason why Ben Stiller's the one yelling in her face. Because Frances Bay is like, can you get that Stiller boy? He's Jerry's son.
Yeah, but you also have the likes of Will Sasso, which will go on to make like huge like
I'm
ripples.
I'm so glad that you brought up Will Sasso. And
how could
me.
You not?
I have to be honest. That was my do not open until Seijin moment for this movie. Was like, I'm not bringing him up. I'm not. I see him. I'm surprised that he's in this movie, but I'm not gonna be the schmuck who brings up Will Sasso.
He becomes this great, like, comedic, like force to be reckoned with as far as side characters go for, oh my God, knocking more shit over on my desk because of how happy I am. But we were talking about Will Sasso. I'm excited. But, like, the idea that, like, he ends up getting to do a whole bunch of stuff. I mean, Mad TV is not the least of it. I mean, there's tons of film moments where he shows up. I mean, including fucking the Three Stooges, which we have, like, ripped apart on our show. Yeah. Right? Like, things like that. So, yeah, but the other guy that I want to point out is Joe Flaherty.
God, Joe Flaherty. Let me tell you, there's a moment in this movie where I'm convinced that Joe Flaherty is playing Joe Flaherty. There's that moment where he's just like, oh, man, like I'm a popular guy and Shooter McGavin's a popular guy and we should be friends. Like Margot Martindale in BoJack Horseman. That's the vibe I get from him. So then later on, when Shooter calls him and he's like, Donnie, I need your help.
He goes, do you want to go to...
Do you want to go to Red Lobster?
No, the second
the
time.
The Sizzler?
Like, shenanigans or like whatever.
Sizzler.
The fuck
you want to hit the Sizzler?
Sizzler. Like, I lost my shit. I was just like, Joe Flaherty is owning this movie.
Yeah, he is. He owns the film. He is such an important part. Jackass. You're going to need suntan lotion. You're spending so much time on the beach.
But that's what... So Sandler is his second outing in film, and like he's able to wrangle a cast of people that will go on to be just comedic forces, and also people that have already established themselves as comedic forces, is like this beautiful, like it's just a great like kind of What it is it's kind of this like peaceful plateau for Sandler where like he got here. This is Billy 5 years later, right? Like he's very level headed. He loses his cool sometimes, but he's very kind of not cool with it when he does. And I'll talk more about that when we get to the end of our show here. But like he kind of finds himself right in this even plane. And there's these weird characters that are around him that both push and pull him into different directions. And like he rides the end of Billy Madison for an entire 90 minutes in this movie, and like it's okay with me because after all of the stupidness I saw in the first like 60 minutes of Billy, and then like finally got to see him be a human at the end, seeing now him get to be human for 90 minutes, I'm very happy with.
Yeah, it's a big step forward for what Adam Sandler is producing. And yeah, if we're going to talk about just comedy and legends and all of that other stuff that you just brought up, Judd Apatow, who mm-hmm. then goes on to become a king of comedy in his own mm-hmm.
right,
did rewrites on the script for Happy Gilmore.
I mean, which I like, not only did he go on to become a king of comedy, but also I personally believe one of his best like existential comedies that he made is What's It's Nuts with Adam Sandler and
Funny
Seth Rogen.
Yeah.
Funny People with the two of them, right? And this like this exploration of the path that Sandler takes versus the path that Rogen is on is, I think, one of the most gorgeously written funny pieces of comedy in the last 20 years.
Yeah, and something that I got plans that we're going to talk about off mic after this episode is,
all right,
is what I'm going to say to get you excited.
Nice.
So then last thing related to Happy Gilmore, and then we'll move on to Laws of the ASCU, is Bob Barker. I feel like Bob Barker deserves more than spay and neuter your pets right now.
Mm-hmm.
He shows up and he is like as big as Carl Weathers is in terms of just like the idea of bringing in and working with an established person. The idea of the one scene cameo with somebody that everybody knows,
yeah,
really takes birth with Bob Barker. And it's in a way that if it weren't Bob Barker playing this role, it would have never happened.
Well, and it works so beautifully in this film. Like the idea that he's on a pro course and so he gets to play with a celebrity, like it doesn't feel forced. And he has celebrity cameos later on in his career, Sandler does, that feel kind of forced. And when I say cameos, I mean even straight up roles.
Right.
I mean, like, I joked about Jack and Jill earlier, but if you tell me that Al Pacino was not a forced cameo for 90 minutes of that film, like, you know, and it doesn't in this one. Like, it feels very natural that somebody shows up, and Bob Barker's the perfect pick, and then he just fucking, he steals this movie.
Dude, and he steals the movie because he's like, I don't want to fight. I don't need a stunt double.
Yeah, so he steals the movie with one line.
Yeah.
And it is when he walks away from the fight, then turns around and just looks at him and goes, bitch. And then walks away with one word. He becomes just a legend because of this movie.
No, the moment for me, right, as great as the bitch is when Happy says, all right, from Let's Make a Deal. He's like, Price is Right. Oh, yeah, sorry. Like,
what is it later on? The Price is Wrong, bitch.
Yeah, Price is Wrong, bitch. Like that thing. That's a classic Sandler line. But it is that like that really human moment of Happy. Like, I know you from a game show.
Yeah.
But I'm not sure which game show.
Yeah, man.
That
yeah.
Like, there's such humanity on display that it makes it so much easier to swallow when it turns into the very first chicken fight from Family yeah. Guy.
Yeah. Oh, man. All right, so I got to know. I got to know what your new rules are.
Oof, new rules for the ASCU. Sports. Sports becomes such a big part of what Adam Sandler is exploring. Especially when you consider the relative lack of sports in something like Billy Madison. I think dodgeball is the furthest that it gets.
Yeah, probably, for sure.
This is the first sports film. And yeah. Adam Sandler goes on, you know, and I can't wait to explore them, to make a lot of films where sports is the easy connection to your audience.
Yep, it becomes part of the everyman trope for him. Is like, I am everyman. I love the Knicks. Is like a huge thing for him later on.
Yeah, and like, you know, theories as to why my father wanted to see Happy Gilmore. My father loves golf, and at the time he liked Adam Sandler. So an Adam Sandler golf film, let's go see it. Also, I'm not entirely unconvinced he didn't think it was Tin Cup that we were going to see.
Phenomenal. Tin Cup 2. Yeah. Happy Gilmore.
Well, they're the same year. Tin Cup and Happy Gilmore are the same year.
Can you believe it? I saw Tin Cup 3 months ago and the sequel's already out.
Yeah, it's crazy. It's absolutely nuts. And it's really crazy when you consider that Kevin Costner was almost in Happy Gilmore.
Oh, my God.
Like, it's, there's just that. But sport as a way to appeal to the masses with his films.
Yes.
Is a huge part. For sure. That actually, now that I've said it and put it into the ASCU, our big tenet of Uncut Gems is not in the Adam Sandler cinematic universe. I already see some cracks in that argument.
Hey, we're going to get there. We're going to get there. And I will stand firm that it does not belong, but we'll get there.
I can't believe it's on the wall. A DVD copy of Uncut Gems under 3 feet of Lucite. And there's a crack in that Lucite right now, Sejan.
Oh, shit. Is anything else that you want to bring up?
Sports is kind of the big one here.
No, yeah. There's not much in this one.
There's not much here. Family is already, like we say that family is key. That's a big part. It extends the size of family to be a third generation. And I think that's important.
I think it also extends it to the point where you have somebody like Otto, which we didn't talk much about in this movie because he does not show up much in this movie. But I have to say, the way in which Otto is treated throughout this film by Happy, to the point where he is there at the end when they celebrate getting the house back, like the idea of family is extended to a point in this film that I think is important going forward.
It's a huge part of it, especially. Yeah. I wanted to see the scene where Otto is named. I know that there's a deleted scene and it's available on YouTube. And honestly, it's not even like a moment where he's like, hey, I need a caddy. What's your name? He just goes up to him and says, Otto, I need you to wake up. So we don't know that Otto is his name other than the fact that he's credited as it. He might just call him that because they met him and he was cleaning his car. Like,
nice. Otto. Did you know that there's a apparent made for TV scene for this movie in which Ben Stiller gets his comeuppance?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, only for the TV version they made like a scene in which Ben Stiller gets the shit kicked out of him.
Yeah, but I mean that kind of undoes a lot of the growth of Happy, where like his anger is in control. He goes from Raphael.
For sure. Yes. No, keep going with that. I need to hear the end of that.
He kind of goes from Raphael to Casey Jones. And I know that I talk about how Casey Jones is what happens if Raphael's anger is not controlled. So really, he goes from Casey Jones to Raphael, but with the sporting equipment. And Casey Jones eventually adopts a daughter named Shadow. And we could talk more about Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles on the Say Report. I've gone off topic of Adam Sandler.
I have my one big thing. One big rule. I think it's important, and I think this is true of even Billy now looking back on it. I just didn't pick up on it. But it is key that Sandler's characters always feel a sense of shame. And that's important for a couple of reasons. First of all, they're smart enough to. They're never as stupid as they appear because they always sense they always have a sense of how they should be behaving in the moment, and they realize, whether it's after the fact or maybe even in the moment, that they're misbehaving. So there is this sense of like shame in which they go about things, super present in this movie, because like he's not proud of how angry he gets or what he does to fight, but he feels like there's like a sense that he has to, despite the fact of how unproud he is. And we see that a lot with the ways in which he speaks to like his grandmother and stuff. Right. Mm-hmm. But also going forward, I think it becomes huge for his characters where they have a sense of regret, a sense of their character is something that they are not proud of and they're hoping to grow out of it. And I think that becomes huge for Sandler's films going like, and as I said, even looking back at Madison, like it didn't really hit me then that is something that's huge in all of these movies. But every single one of his characters feels that sense of shame going forward.
True. That's important too. And I think that's what I was like touching on when I say that Happy Gilmore is real. Like he feels like a real person.
Yeah.
And just a regular dude. And that's, I mean, a thing that separates us from, well, God's creation of us, if we're going to go off the Bible, is that we ate from the tree of knowledge and now understand what shame is.
Right. Yeah. Right.
Because, like, just fuck me. I'll get theological on this, right? We're talking about creating universes. I am become God, creator of Sandler universes.
I have looked into the abyss and Sandler stared back.
And he said,
man.
Hey, buddy.
Hey, guy.
Hey, guy.
Somebody's closer.
Happy learned how to pun.
Excellent.
Oh man. All right. Anything else? Any other law? I think that's it. The real issue, and actually I'll have something. I'm cutting you off. I was going to throw to you, but I'm cutting you off. I feel like we may have done ourselves a disservice starting with Billy Madison. And just in the fact that this is such a better distillation of what Billy Madison was trying to be.
I've always stood by the idea that the sequel is the true art that the artist was trying to make, right?
Right.
And this is mostly evident in things like video games, where like they didn't have the budget or the fan base to prove themselves. Every time you see an Uncharted 2, it's really what they wanted to do with Uncharted, right? Like and I think that's true of a lot of games. And I think that's true of film. Like I think a lot of people give a lot of shit to sequels, and they shouldn't, because the sequel is the opportunity for the artists to come in and say, like, hey, motherfuckers, we own the leash now. Like, we get to say when we stop. And I think that's true here. I think that as much as it's not a sequel to Billy Madison, it is definitely a spiritual sequel. And I think this is the opportunity for Sandler and people around him to say, like, you get to do what you want now.
Yeah, Billy Madison is the proof of the concept. It's not just proof of concept, it's proof the concept works. And then going forward, he gets to build his universe the way that we're observing right now. So it really, as we talked about it, this movie becomes more important to charting and choreographing is not the word, being cartographers of the Adam Sandler universe.
I'll give you choreographing. Yeah. There's definitely a lot of stuff that we see in this movie that we see beat for beat in other films, but we'll talk about that when we get there.
That's a good point. And after all, at this point, we've only just begun. Are you going to say anything?
No, I'm just smiling. I'm just smiling over here. God, man. Carl Weathers, like, in this movie and, like, as, like, the first big great that he gets, I love it. And the fact that we get to see him come back later, I'm excited to talk about it. Yeah. This movie just, that I think that's more than anything, is, like, as much as you're right that there's a lot going on in this movie that you can pull apart and you can point at as being, like, amateurish in a lot of ways, the ways in which it lays out the groundwork for him to get better as a comedic artist later on, like, I'm just excited to now talk about future films after this movie. So that's where I am.
Yeah, no, I can't disagree. And actually, having thought of it in terms of Caddyshack, having gotten to that point in this discussion, that's the beauty of something like the reason why when you show Caddyshack to somebody who didn't see it at a formulative age for comedy, they don't really like it, is because Caddyshack is, we're going to do whatever the fuck we want, and that's going to be our movie. So,
and
like,
then you get to make Caddyshack too,
and
right?
Yep.
Right?
Right? Mm-hmm. Right? I walked right into that one.
But I am right there with you, man.
Yeah.
It's a bunch of dudes that are just given carte blanche to make the movies that they want to make. And we talked very early about that being a thing for Sandler, is that he is in a position very early in his career and for the rest of his career to just do whatever the fuck he wants. Because he brings in so much money for people that people are just like, yeah, man, what the fuck? Sure. Bring David Spade back for a fifth film. Let's do this shit. And like, it works. Like, it pays off. And I think this is where we first get to see that inkling of Sandler getting to be the comedian and movie maker that he wants to be. He doesn't have full control yet, but he's in a position to say, like, dude, I got this. I did this last time. I can do it again. And like, this is the first inkling we get of that.
Very true. Very, very true. And yeah, and also if I'm Adam Sandler and I'm selling this movie as it's Caddyshack, of course it's gonna just be little skits in the body of the movie. So it makes sense. He made the movie I think he told people he was gonna make. And yeah. And at the end of the day, isn't that the most important thing of all if you're trying to put your mark on a comedic landscape? Mm-hmm. I guess we'll find out as we go deeper into the Adam Sandler cinematic universe. So if you like what you heard here, these only come out once a month, and you want to hear more of Seijin and I, you can find us on the Say Report. That's out there. Probably the same place you got this. If you want to talk to either of us directly, you can get in touch with me at Devin D. Decker on Twitter.
And you can hit me up at Siege versus the World.
All right. So until next time, we'll see you in the Sandlerverse. Thank you so much for listening to the Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe podcast. If you like what you heard, you can subscribe so it's delivered straight to you. And why not write or review? If you want to get in touch with us on Twitter, we're at the ASCU. And you can always send an electronic mail to Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe at gmail.com. Thank you so much for listening. Apologize to your mother for me, and we'll see you next time.